my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Charlie from Austin, Texas.
Woo! Hey, everybody. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. It's a good-looking bunch of folks. I wear a suit and tie when I get behind the podium out of respect for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that came before me and all the work that goes into putting something like this together. But every time I put it on, I always think, you know, what I'm most comfortable, what I feel like standing there and going, no contest, Your Honor. It's my experience, you know. I never had much of a defense. No contest was my best angle. I want to thank Bob for asking me to come talk. It's a real honor to be here. Katie and I come out here a lot, and we started coming to this group, and a friend of mine introduced me and Bob, and we like this meeting so much that we've started coming on Thursday mornings instead of Friday mornings so we can make this meeting, because it really is, you know, if you go around, the more meetings you go to, the more you appreciate what a hell of a fine AA group this is, and it's just a real honor to speak here, and I know how much work. I can't imagine trying to put this together every week. I know how much work it is to put something like this together, and I know there's a lot of people that do it besides Bob, and then I'm also sure if it's anything like my group, there's a lot of people that don't do a damn thing, but have a lot of ideas about how it could be done better, you know? it's the way it is at my group. It's hard to get anything through sometimes. I was authorized by Group Conscious to bring you greetings from the Primary Purpose Group in Austin, Texas. The vote was 40-22, but we got it through. I'm glad to be here tonight, and you know, and there's different theories about what we do when we get up here, what we talk about. A lot of people talk about that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. I'm also real fond of the definition on page 50, where it says, in our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Whether we agree with the particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. There are questions for each individual to settle for himself. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. So here we are. My story, I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I grew up in a pretty normal family. A friend of mine likes to say that normal is a setting on a washing machine, but I don't know exactly what normal is, but I've heard enough fifth steps over the years to know that there was a lot of guys that had it a lot worse than I had it growing up. I was the only alcoholic in my family. I'm still the only alcoholic in my family, but I always felt a little different. When I say I grew up in a normal family, I should mention that my sister was perfect, though. I grew up behind a sister that was 5 years older than me, and she was National Honor Society and first chair flautist and drum majorette and drill team and you name it, and she joined it, and then she kind of had this thuggish little brother. But my mother was a first grade teacher for 42 years, so I was well prepared for the first grade. I like to think I held it together pretty good through elementary school, you know, which was a challenge. But, I don't know if this happened to anybody else, but I kept hearing about potential when I was growing up. Did anybody else suffer under the burden of potential? You know, and in my, you know, then why can't you be like Charles across the street? And I'm thinking, I'm really not holding back that much, you know? I mean, I don't know if there's a whole lot of untapped resources here, but you know, that's the way it went along. And I started drinking when I was 16. And I used to think that was young, you know, but now people are sobering up at like 8, you know? I mean, you're chairing a meeting and the guy comes up and you're like, oh, who's your daddy? And they're like, no, I'm here for a 90-day chip, you know? Welcome, you know? And, you know, and God love them. I'm not, you know, I was young when I got to this program. I mean, when I sobered up 22 years ago, 28 was pretty young to get sober, you know, and Katie was 26, and she had 4.5 months on me, and still does, and will never let me live it down. I've kept her sober a few times by telling her that if she drank, I'd sponsor her if she came back. But we were part of a young crew. But I guess the reason I was talking about my drinking, and for me, it started at 16, and it would make a pretty macho story to stand up here and say that I drank a bottle of whiskey every day from the day I was 16 until I sobered up, but that wouldn't be true. But what is the truth for me is that from the day that I took that first drink until I had to quit, I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded under any circumstances for any reason. There was never a time when I would say, no, it's my mother's birthday, I really shouldn't, or, I need to be somewhere by November, or, you know, anything like that. I was an absolute devotee. I was all about getting loaded, and I believe heavily in AA's singleness of purpose. You know, I mean, we talk a lot about one drunk working with another one, and there's an importance of that identification of one drunk talking to another one that's so important that out of the 200 or 300 12-step fellowships that are out there, really the only difference is the first half of the first step. You know, I think that identification is that important, that, you know, because for me, and if you drink like I do, people always want to talk to you about your drinking, you know, and they say really stupid stuff, you know, if they don't understand, you know. And our book talks about one of us properly armed with the facts about himself can win the confidence of a new man in a couple of hours, but that's a pretty big deal because nobody else had ever done it, you know. I mean, you know, I like to tell a story about it. I was in a treatment center one time. We're talking about identification. It was Christmas time, and I was in treatment, and it was Christmas Day, and I'm a big boy now, but I was quite a bit bigger at that time, and they had given us our turkey and dressing and everything, and I was pretty interested in the dinner, and in walks this group of people from one of the local churches, you know, and they were a group of local do-gooders that were going to come sing to the heathen drunks, and this woman was going along from person to person, and she would bend over and she'd talk to this guy, and then she'd bend over and she'd talk to this guy, and then she'd bend over and talk to another, and when she got to me, she said, are you a patient here? I said, yes, I am. And she goes, I know exactly what you're going through. And I thought, really? And she said, I was once addicted to caffeine. I was like, ain't that a bitch, you know? Did you ever pawn your mom's Sterling to get a can of Folgers, you know? I mean, I feel you, sister, you know, but you know, bless her heart, she was trying to identify, but it just wasn't there. But, you know, that's why I think our singleness of purpose is so important, and that's why it's so important for me to get with people that suffer from the same problem that I have. I qualify for a number of 12-step fellowships, and But when I'm in AA, I like to try to talk about alcoholism. And I really do believe in my heart of hearts that my problem always was alcoholism. My alcoholism led me to do a lot of things besides drink alcohol. Let's just say that. It's a bit of a struggle for me to not talk about outside issues. When you get here, there's a lot of terms that I don't know if it's happened to anybody else, but it felt like people were speaking a foreign language when I got here. And they're talking about Mr. Bill and Dr. Bob and this step and that tradition and turn it over and, don't judge anybody but stick with winners and all this. And I heard this term, drug of choice. I thought that was so cute, did anybody talk like that on the street? I don't ever remember a time where you're going, oh, I'm sorry, that's not my particular drug of choice. My drug of choice was whatever you got, and I'll just leave it there. I guess I can sum it up with a few things about, at one point I had an apartment, I was staying in an apartment. I used to say I had an apartment, but really the truth was two guys had an apartment that they were paying the rent on, and I was staying there. And one of them made his living off of outside issues, and the other one was my bartender. And the short version of the story is that both of them thought that I was getting too loaded, And when your dealer and your bartender are giving you shame, you maybe have overshot the mark a little bit. But I know there's a lot of new people here tonight, and I want to welcome the new people here tonight. But I mean, does anybody need for me to explain how to drink to them? If not, let's just kind of move on into a little recovery there, because I just don't have time in 45 minutes to talk a whole lot about drinking. But I wrecked a few cars. I got a few DWIs. I lost, but. I guess the key thing about my drinking was I spent years in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever it would be my turn, I would raise my hand and I'd say, I'm Charlie, I'm an alcoholic. And looking back on it, I had no idea what that meant. I thought that I must be alcoholic because, for one thing, I drink every day. The other thing, I've had DWIs and gone to jail and lost jobs and houses and cars and girlfriends and all the stuff that happens to us. And I thought, I must be alcoholic, And really, I'd been around quite a while, I think, before I really understood what it truly means to be alcoholic. And if you're new, I just want to take a second to touch on the physical allergy and the mental obsession, because we are different from normal drinkers. I can't pour enough vodka into my sister to make her an alcoholic. But I could pour enough vodka in her to get her a DWI or, to wreck the car and that sort of thing, but that wouldn't make her an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is that I have a physical allergy to alcohol, and the way that shows up in my life and the way it's described so well in the doctor's opinion and the first 43 pages of this book is that my symptom of that allergy is this phenomenon of craving, but the book is full of terms and phrases that I didn't feel when I would read them, my sponsor likes to say that handing a new guy a big book and expecting him to get what's in there is like giving him a flight manual to an F-16. And saying, and when you get through reading that, we've got one out here in the parking lot. Try not to hurt yourself or anybody else, But a lot of these terms didn't mean much to me. So it really helped to have somebody that had been in the book to explain that stuff to me. But, when it talked about the phenomenon of craving, I didn't really understand what that meant, but I did know what it meant to stop in for only two and get thrown out at the end of the night or go missing for a few days and, you know, that sort of thing. And to me, that's what happens. When I take a drink of alcohol, it triggers a craving in me where I got no control over how much I'm going to drink or when I'm going to stop. And then the book talks about that for about the doctor's opinion at first 22 pages, then about 23 or 24, it switches over and says, that wouldn't mean anything. You know, if, and the weird thing is that, you know, if alcohol was my problem, I'd only have to stop drinking one time. You know, I mean, my problem is that I can't stop starting. I have always been sober when I took the first drink. So I make that decision sober. And my biggest problem is what goes on in my brain when I'm not drinking. But inside of me, you know, another term that's in the book that never made much sense to me was the term that, I mean, I never actually felt it, was that term spiritual malady. You know, the book describes a spiritual malady. It's a little fuzzy for me, but when you stand up at the podium of AA and talk about that hole in my middle, that hole that I felt from elementary school, that feeling of separation, that feeling of being a little bit less than, of being not good enough, not smart enough, I can't do what regular people do, I think we can identify with that. That, to me, is the spiritual malady. And I got that going on, you know, and what happens is, when people want to talk to me about my drinking, I'm thinking, you really don't know what you're talking about, you know, because if you understood what that drink does for me, it's the only thing I've ever found that will quiet that feeling of separation, that hole I got right here. And okay, sure, occasionally I overshoot the mark and I wreck the car and I lose the job, or maybe, you know, I get kicked out of an apartment or people don't want to talk to me anymore, but I'll take that deal because of what that drink does for me. And when somebody says you need to not drink, I'm thinking, if you understood what that drink does, I can see why from your viewpoint you would say stupid shit like that. But if you knew what that drink does for me, you would know that alcohol is my solution. It's my problem, because the thing that happens to the other side of what makes me alcoholic is that when I stop drinking, I don't get better. You know, our book says that we're restless, irritable, and discontented until I can again experience the ease and comfort that comes from taking a couple of drinks. That's the guy that when he's been dry for a while, people say, for God's sakes, man, why don't you take a drink? You know, you are one miserable bastard. You know, you're more miserable sober than you are. And what happens with me is that mental obsession. I don't feel better when I stop drinking. It starts rolling around up in my head, and my head starts, I love, Bob said it one time when he was talking, he said, you know, it talks about being restless, irritable, and discontented, and he said one time when I was listening to him, he said, he doesn't get discontented, he said, he just starts to notice things, and and boy, that's me, you know, I start to notice the people in traffic, I start to notice that son of a bitch in the express lane has got 14 items in his basket, and I know because I counted them while we were standing here, you know, and it's just this, and what happens, and then the guy at work is getting 50 cents an hour more than I do, and I'm doing all the work while the guy up in the air-conditioned trailer is making all the money, and before long, you know, I'm not getting my fair share, and for God's sakes, Charlie, come on, let's take another run at it, man. I mean, it won't be like it was last time. I mean, we'll manage it better this time. And really, if you think about it, last time wasn't that bad. I mean, you might have been a little hasty checking yourself into that treatment center, for God's sake. You know, I mean, you know, it was just a bad weekend. And eventually, that's what happens, where eventually my brain says, by God, I think you're right. You know, and that's what happens. And I get stuck in that. So to me, what it means to be alcoholic, when I say my name's Charlie and I'm alcoholic, is that I've got that physical allergy where I react funny to alcohol, and I've got a mental obsession that is eventually going to drive me back to drinking again. Driven by that spiritual malady, my mental obsession is eventually going to get me drunk every time. I cannot stop drinking on my own. And I spend a lot of time explaining that at a treatment center in Austin. Because I've always felt like if a guy goes to treatment and gets a full grasp of the first step, the treatment has been a success. You know, I mean, I've seen plenty of times where people have done the first five steps as a term of graduating from a treatment center, but not really have step one. And for me, in my mind, step one drives everything, you know, because the book says we had to admit to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. And to me, that means in here, not up here, but where I'm really going, wow, dude, I got it. I got what you're talking about. I am a garden variety drunk. You know, I am going to drink until I have to get sober, and then I will stay sober until I have to drink. And that cycle can go on for a long, long time. You know, so that's to me, what it happens was, it starts spiraling downhill, though, you know, in little ticks. I give up a little of my dignity. I compromise a little bit of my values. I'm willing to settle for a little bit less out of life. But it goes down like tick, 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 like this. So yesterday is never that much different from today, you know. And when that's what the book's talking about when it says we get to where we can't differentiate the truth from the false. Our alcoholic life seems like the only one because it's a whole lot like yesterday was, you know. I mean, I'm just doing what I got to do to get by. And, you know, I don't go from up here to down here overnight. But for me, what happened was it really started getting sloppy. After a while, I left a bar in a blackout one night, and I rammed into a car, and I was still rolling, so I abandoned the car, reported it stolen, and like any good drunk would. And as I'm running back to this bar in a blackout, I remember seeing two policemen looking at the car I'd run into, and I thought, good grief, they got here fast. But I kept going, and the next day, they said, you're going to have to take a polygraph test to get your car back, Mr. Parker. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, your car was involved in an accident before it was reported stolen. I said, you're kidding. And he said, no, they ran into a parked police car. And I thought, that explains how they got there so fast. You know, I mean, you know, but you know, when you think about how things could have gone, man, I was in a complete blackout. And if those cops had been standing there, you'd have a different speaker tonight, you know? I mean, because 22 years later, I might still be in the joint. But I was lucky enough. But what I'm talking about was it started getting really sloppy. I used to come out to Vegas a lot, and I used to get free airplane tickets. Well, I used to steal airplane tickets. I didn't get free airplane tickets. I used to. And we would come out here, and sometimes I'd come out here with like $100 in my pocket back in the 70s. And I remember I was telling Katie, now this is how cool I was when I got here. Me and a buddy of mine were up at the Sahara, and we're staying down at the marina where the MGM is now. And I went broke. And so I go over and I find Mitch, and I go, how you doing? He goes, I'm tapped. And when we're talking about tapped, I mean, no credit cards, no, yeah. So here we are 6 miles away, and we're walking from at 6 o'clock in the morning. And right out in front of this deal, I saw a bunch of lights, and there was a guy throwing money in the air, and I started, you know, kind of positioning to see if one of those hundreds blew, and I'm kind of getting ready to make my move, you know, and this guy goes, hey, hey, hey! And I look over, and It was a set for that TV show Vegas, and they were shooting a scene, you know, and I'm over there trying to figure out how I can get, you know, and so that's how cool I was, you know. But towards the end, I was really fond of the pawn shops, and I like to tell this story for a number of reasons, but I liked the pawn shops. I liked the way you could go in there, and it was a very pure transaction. You just gave them whatever it was, and they gave you the money. And they never said, "Weren't you just in here?" You know, or "What do you want with this money? What are you going to do with this money?" I mean, it was just you went in, you got out, but I would pull a scam He had 90 days to get everything out. And in the 90-day period, I could usually come up with something to get everything out. But one day I had claimed, I don't want to give anybody ideas, but I had pulled a little scam that netted enough money to get everything out, and I came out of a 5-day blackout. I'm talking 5 days, don't remember a thing. I came out of this blackout, and I was sitting on the side of the bed, and I should say that I was at my mother's house. I was so mistreated as a child that I ran away from home at 28 years old. But I stayed a few places here and there, but I come out of this blackout at my mom's house, and I got $8 in my pocket, and I still had this gangster wad of pawn tickets. And you've probably experienced mornings like that, where you just go, oh, no, I shot my wad, on this deal, and now, so I would have to get up and go to my father. I forgot to tell you the one downside of the pawn shop things. I didn't own very much stuff, so I had the pawn stuff that didn't belong to me. So, and that creates hard feelings amongst your friends and family. And so on this morning, I had to go to my father and say, Dad, if we act now, I can get you a really good deal on all of your stuff. But if we wait till tomorrow, it's out of my hands. And I would do that, but the thing about it was Dallas was a big town, and it wasn't just we're going to go to the pawn shop. We had to go to Buckner Boulevard and then Garland Road and then Harry Hines and then over to Oak Cliff. I left your deer rifle over here, and I left your metal detector out in Garland. And it was, the short version of the story is that it was all day in the car with me and my dad and all that shame. And the reason I like to tell this story is because most of us have experienced that kind of shame coming in here. And the other thing that we've experienced is powerlessness, because what I would do when I was in the car with my dad that day was I would say, Dad, I swear to God, I will never do this again. And if I was lying to my father, I didn't know it. I meant it with every fiber of my being. I will never do this again. My dad was a good man, and he didn't deserve the kind of treatment that he was getting from his son, and nobody had given him his stuff. He had worked for it and paid for it, and I'm in there stealing it and pawning it, and I knew that was messed up. But he gave me a couple of days, and I would hit his house like a cat burglar. And we made the rounds of the pawn shops 3 times, me and my father. So that's how slick I was. That's how cool I was when I got here. I wasn't hanging with Puff Daddy or whatever he calls himself now. And Donald Trump. I was stealing shit out of the back door of my family's house and just a real rotten bastard. And, that's the guy that showed up here for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sobered up that time, and, I was pretty serious about the program at that time. But what I was real serious about was going to a lot of meetings. What we're doing here tonight is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when we used to have this circle and a triangle on it in our books, it had 3 sides to that triangle. And there's 3 sides to my recovery. Unity is what we're doing tonight. And then service is what I do when I'm going out working with new guys, going to the treatment centers and stuff like that. And then recovery is working the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor, hopefully the way they're lined out in the big book. But what I did in that first period of sobriety was, and I bring this up because I think it's a dangerous thing that's been going on in our fellowship. We sobered up at a funny time. I've been sober, today's 22 years. And during that time, oh, thank you. Believe me, that's That's a testament to the power of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's got very little to do with the power of Charlie. But during this period of time, we got a shitload of AA meetings, you know, as they say in Texas. I guess, you know, that would translate to a whole lot. But you know, I don't think when they wrote the book that they ever foresaw a time when a guy would be able to stay sober by just going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I don't think they ever dreamed that there would be a time that we would focus on the fellowship more than the recovery program. You know, because they were getting together maybe once a week, or maybe they didn't have a meeting at all in their town. What they had was the big book and the program of recovery lined out in it. So what I saw with me was I would go to a meeting, you know, I'd get enough relief to get me to the next day, go out and just destroy the world with self-will in the meantime, but then, you know, I'd come into the meeting the next day and I would rock along and I was staying sober on just on the fellowship. Now, I'm not knocking the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. I love the fellowship of AA. I love drunks. I love hanging out with them before I sobered up, after I sobered up. We go to conferences and a lot of stuff I love. But the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous will keep me sober right up to the point that I get drunk, you know, and I drank with 10 and a half months of sobriety. I've had my sobriety date's been March 22nd two different times. It was March 22nd of 84, March 22nd of 85, and I wasn't trying to do anything cute there. It just happened. But I got 20 minutes to talk about some of what's going on sober. When I talk, I like to talk to the guys that are new, because if you drink like I do, there is a program here that really works. I mean, you know, and the hardest thing to convince a new guy is how simple this program is, you know. I mean, if you just do what a sponsor tells you to do, I thought I had to understand the process and approve of the process. You know, but it doesn't mean anything. I just have to understand the directions, you know. Just go do this little piece of work and then come back and talk to my sponsor the next day. And then, you know, he'll give me another piece of work and you look up at the end of it and it's better. But, you know, what happened for me was going to all those meetings. My sponsor, I should mention my sponsor, Mark Houston, is my sponsor, and he says a lot of things that I really like, but one of the things that he said was, don't let anybody read your big book for you. And what I was doing was I was sitting in those AA meetings, and I was trying to get AA through what you people were saying in the meetings, you know? And the more I get in the book, the more I see how much, what's a polite word for bullshit, Katie? Is going on in the AA meetings, you know, and I hear stuff enough that I start thinking that it's AA, you know. I mean, if I come to AA meetings and 6, 8, 10, 20 times I hear somebody say, "This is a selfish program," well, must be AA, you know, and then you start reading the book, I can't find it, anywhere where it says, you know, this is a selfish program. I think it says on page 15, I mean, it's all about destruction of self. And it says here, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. That kind of stuff is all in the book. I don't find the part where it says, you know, this is a selfish program, you know, take what you need and leave the rest, and, you know, and that sort of thing. But I'm getting on a little soapbox here. I got to watch myself. But, you know, the other one was put the plug in the jug, you know. Never did figure that one out. You know, to me, that's like this far from Nancy Reagan's "Just Say No." You know, I mean, it's like If I could put the plug in the jug, I wouldn't be parking my ass in these AA meetings for 22 years, you know. Another one that bugs me is when they talk about if you sober up a horse thief. They may only say this in Texas, but if you sober up a horse thief, you got a sober horse thief. Have y'all heard that one? What bullshit is that? You know, I mean, I guarantee you the guy's not going to stay a sober horse thief for long. You know, my program talks about change. And if I stay the same creepy bastard that I was when I got here, I'm not going to be around for long, you know, whether I'm going to 3 meetings a day or not. But, you know, I stayed sober this first time, and I was kind of working the program a lot. We got 15 minutes left. This is good. The other day I was talking, and a buddy of mine was talking in Dallas at the same time. And he called me the next morning, Tom Pick, and I said, "How'd you talk, Coach Tom?" And he goes, "Oh, goddamn, I did it again." No, he said that to me. And I said, "I did it again." He goes, "What?" And I said, "I looked up 40 minutes into the talk, and I was still drunk." And he goes, "That's all right. Two-thirds of the way through my talk, I was 13, you know? So if I'm not careful, I'll talk about drinking the whole time, and then, you know, I've got 7 minutes to talk about 22 years of recovery." But what happened for me was I was pretty serious about that, reading the big book and going to big book meetings and hanging out with people that were fairly serious about this program. But what started happening, I didn't see happening. I started reading the book. I don't know about anybody else, but I like to read stuff that I agree with. You know, I mean, you know how you just, you read along and then you just kind of glaze over the stuff that, and then some of it you go, "Oh yeah, see, there it is. That's exactly what I said. You know, I said that in a meeting yesterday." But, you know, but then my sponsor talks about this thing, and I want to share it with you. And some of you have probably heard of the set-aside prayer, but it has helped me so much in recovery. We do this little prayer before we do the work, before we read the book, before I work with a sponsee. Where I say, "God," it's pretty simple, and you can say it any way you want, but I just say, "God, please help me set aside everything that I think that I know about this book and this process and this way of life, and help me see the truth." You know, and it's amazing how I see new stuff on the page, you know, and I don't know what goes through these minds of these guys I'm sponsoring, you know, where we're sitting down with the book, you know, and here's their sponsor with 20 years, you know, and we're doing the fourth step, and we're reading along, and I go, "Holy shit, look at that," you know. It's like, that's a prayer, you know, and let's get down on our knees, you know, and let's do it. But I mean, I keep seeing new stuff in this book all the time. I went through this flat period in my sobriety, and I'm kind of dancing around that, but what happened for me was I thought I did it pretty hardcore for the first 4.5 years. I'm just going to go ahead and say this because I don't have that much shame about it, but somehow in the book, I missed the whole selfishness piece. I mean, I don't know if this happened to anybody. If this only happened to me, praise God. But what happened for me was I went along and I kind of acted like my problem was alcohol. And I'm going to give you a run through the steps the way I understood them the first time. Is that my problem was alcohol. And that I came to believe that this God that you guys talked about had removed your problem with alcohol. So it might work for me. I'd made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care. I had no idea what that means. I knew that I was kind of supposed to act like I'd turned my life over to God. But I didn't really. I missed the whole part about being convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success or anything. The book takes a bizarre turn on page 60. And if you're not paying attention, you'll just miss it, you know, or I did anyway. And you know, and because it spent all that time talking about my drinking, and then it takes this hard right where it says, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem, you know, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. though he usually doesn't think so, you know. And I kind of had this understanding that I was going to do a fourth step, and because what I was going to do, I was going to write down all the stuff that made me feel bad about me. Because if I felt better about me, then I wouldn't need to drink, right? And then the same thing in the fifth step. We're going to share this stuff. And then we get to six and seven, and it was like, not really getting it. But we rolled on to eight. I made a list of the people I'd harmed because making amends to these people was going to make me feel better about me. And then, you know, so I could be out in the world without worrying about getting my ass kicked. And, you know, and so I'm going to make amends to these people. And then in nine, and then in 10 and 11, I'm going to try to clean up as I'm going along. And then in 11, I'm going to, you know, keep trying to feel good about me. And then in the 12th step, I'm going to go out and I'm going to talk to people about me. And you know, and that was, it's a little oversimplified, but I mean, looking back on it, that's a lot of what my understanding was. And it was based on the thinking that my problem was alcohol, right? Because anything, you know, it was all about getting me separated from alcohol. But what I was in was absolute self-will, self-centeredness, self-obsession, self-seeking, all those self-words that they put in the fourth edition somehow. Katie and I should say, were best friends for 20 years. And her husband passed. Oh, by the way, today's Katie's 49th birthday, by the way. We were best friends for 20 years, and she was married, and I was in a series of relationships, she was the first woman friend I ever had, and we spent 20 years together, and there was never any innuendo or improper. Well, one time when she said that, she goes, you know, your sobriety birthday is the same day as my naked birthday, and I said, well, you know, we should celebrate together, you know? I'll stay sober. And she goes, Charlie. You know, I mean, but we've been dating for about, her husband passed away, and I was in a plane crash in 2003, and I wound up, everybody that was on that plane went a little crazy, and we all survived, but not by much. I mean, the short version of the story is we lost power flying from the East Hampton Airport back to Manhattan, and crashed into the Peconic Bay at night, went underwater, the doors wouldn't open. It's pretty hairy, but we got out, but not by much. But it was the beginning of a spiritual awakening for me, because I really started looking at things a little bit different, and I started working with some new people, and I went to this John Henry in Austin, and I said, John Henry, I'm so self-centered that I can't even have a conversation with somebody. You know, I have to just force myself to say, how are the kids, you know, or act like I give a flip while they're, you know, answering, you know, and, you know, how's the wife, and, you know, because I'm all about me, you know. I was, and this is 17 years sober, so part of this is really, I'm talking more to people that have been around for a while, and maybe you feel like you're not experiencing what you hear some people describe as the benefits of this program. Because during that time, if you'd have came to me and said, Charlie, what you need is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what you need is to get into that big book. I'm not hearing God in anything you're talking about. It's all about you. And I would have said, no, you don't understand. You know, I've been in AA for 17 years. I've got some merit badges in this society. I've got a little credit. You know, just shut up and back off. But what he said was, come meet with me tomorrow and we'll go down to the ranch. That's Austin Recovery has a place they call the ranch. Bob's been out there with me, and we'll talk to the guys that are in detox and treatment. And the reason I bring this up, because it did not sound like a good idea. You know, has anybody ever been pressed into service work by your sponsor? It never Sounds like a good idea. I did not want to go. They're going to want to talk about themselves, and I want to talk about me. But what happened was when I got in there and I started working with these guys, and what I'm getting to is that my most significant spiritual awakening came in this program with 17 years of sobriety. And I'm talking about a profound spiritual awakening. I've been on fire with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for the past 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And I have learned more about this program. When I talk about don't let anybody read your big book for you, I mean, I got into that book and I started, you know, guys would ask me to sponsor them. And you know, I'm going to want to have the answers, you know, when a guy. So there were times where I felt like I was one step ahead of these guys, you know. I mean, I'd say, read the doctor's opinion. And then I'd go home and go, okay, you know, I guess. And I'm in the work, you know, because I want to have the right answers for them. I won't do it to save my ass, but I'll do it to save theirs. And what happened was I started having newer and newer experiences with this program. And I also don't want to be a phony bastard in AA, so I'm not willing to tell a guy, you need to be doing this every day if I'm not doing it myself. Because to me, that's the beginning of the end. You know, if I'm saying, you need to be doing something that I'm not doing. So it pressed me into the work, and I started sponsoring these guys, and I started seeing the light come on in these guys. And if you've never experienced that, that is the magic that happens in this program by Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I say that is if you've been around a while, you know, the real magic is in working with others. And if it doesn't sound like a good idea, that's okay. And if you feel like you're not capable, I'd been around a long time, but I didn't really feel totally equipped to work with a brand new drunk. I do now, but then I didn't. But I started working with them anyway, and they didn't know the difference. And we got to hope God's involved somewhere anyway, you know. And the other thing I was going to say, talking about not knowing the difference, one of the other things that bugs me in AA is this thing about the newcomer picking out a sponsor. You know, I mean, I've seen guys come in that are brand new, and you remember what it's like on day one. You can't find the water fountain, and I'm supposed to try to figure out who's going to be an appropriate sponsor for me. I like to go, if I see a new guy and nobody else takes him, I'll go up and go, hey man, you're going to need somebody to show you what we do around here. And, you know, they call it a sponsor, and I'll be willing to do it. And they go, thanks. You know, I mean, it's too important of a decision to leave up to a newcomer. You know, I mean, so, yeah. So, I mean, this thing about, you know, here's my number. I say, take their number. You know, and you know, and I call them and say, you know, how you doing, man? What, you know, that, but the last few years, and Jesus, I wish I had another 30 minutes to talk about what's been going on. But I mean, I remember sitting there with Katie one time, and I was reading the book, and I go, Jesus, there is self all over this thing. And she goes, you really never see that before? And I went, no. And she goes, that's some pretty basic shit, Charlie. And I was like, missed it, you know. I mean, but I'm in it now. And what I didn't see happening was during that flat period of my sobriety, what had happened for me was I'd been sober for a while, and then maybe a few things started not really going my way. I had back-to-back divorces, and I kept getting knocked to the mat every time I would step into the ring of a relationship. And I started thinking, you know, I don't know if I thought it out loud, but I remember thinking, you know, I tried it your way, I'm getting screwed here. And what happened was self-will snuck its way back into my life. And I started trying to get what I could. There's part of me that believes what God can do for Katie and what God can do for Bob. But there's a part of me that thinks I can get myself a little bit better deal, you know, than what God's going to give me. And so that self-will starts coming in, and the more self-will I got going on, the less room there is for God's will. And then there's less God consciousness, and next thing you know, I'm totally in self-will, and I don't even know that it happened. And the last thing I want to say is, that whole time when I was in that flat period, if you'd have said to me, I would have said, you know, okay, I'm not sponsoring any new guys, and I'm not I mean, I'm going to a few meetings, but I'm not reading the book and I'm not doing any service work, but I'm not thinking about drinking, right? One day Katie says, you know, you take that guy that's in that position and you let him blow his knee out in a motorcycle wreck or get a root canal, you hand him a bottle full of Vicodin, and 2 weeks later, the guy with 17 years sober is going, what the hell just happened? You know, how did I pick up again? And, you know, so I don't really know exactly how close I was to picking up at that point, but I'm truly grateful to have made it through there sober. And the thing that I would say is if you've been around this program a while, a few years, maybe we lose a lot of folks between 3 years and 18, 20 years of sobriety that just kind of start backing out, and here comes self-will, and they start thinking, you know, this isn't the deal for me, and then they twist off for one reason or the other. So if you've got some time in this program and you're thinking that you're not getting the deal you hear, and I'm not talking about me as a shining example, but when you hear these big speakers talking about the stuff they've experienced as a result of working this program and working with others, and if you feel like you're not getting it, it's still available. Just get in the book, get into the work. If you don't feel comfortable doing it, get with somebody that is comfortable doing it and get them to show you how to do it. And you know, I'm going to close with one thing on page 100 of our book. I know I'm out of time. But it says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently be in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I am truly honored to be 22 years sober tonight and to be with you folks, and I really appreciate you letting me come up here and talk. Thanks a lot.